you know, one person. I certainly do not deserve this.
This year's Nobel Peace Prize goes to a Venezuelan opposition leader whose fight for democracy has forced her into hiding.
For Friday, October 10th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead, will the Gaza War ceasefire hold?
We will pose that question to a top voice in U.S. foreign policy.
Also, the Trump administration is beginning to lay off federal employees as a government shutdown lingers into a possible third week.
The further we go, the deeper we get dug in.
And the American sport of mountain biking gets its first American World Cup champion in decades.
You don't get many fairy tale moments in sports. You get a lot of hard moments, a lot of harsh reality. But that was definitely a culmination of really my whole career.
Those stories after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Israeli troops have pulled out from parts of Gaza today as a ceasefire went into effect. NPR's Anas Baba reports crowds of Palestinians who were displaced during the war are returning to places that used to be Israeli military zones.
I walk through Gaza City now, and it feels like I'm witnessing a place being born again. On every corner, there is reunion, silent embraces, dust-covered faces pressed together. The joy of surviving here doesn't erase the grief. Yes, there is entire blocks now, looks like an open graves, only debris. But Gazans here, they don't wait for permission to live. They carry hope like oxygen. Gaza is not only rubble. Gaza is resilience. And what I see today is people writing themselves back into existence. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
Travelers might see a new video message from Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem at their local airport. In it, Noem blames Democrats for the ongoing government shutdown. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more.
The ongoing government shutdown is causing some delays at airports across the country, and people perhaps waiting in line for TSA security a bit longer might see a new video from the Trump administration that acknowledges the slowdown. The video blames the delays on Democrats in Congress for refusing to fund the federal government. Both Republicans and Democrats have refused to negotiate over the terms of a short-term spending bill. The videos will be rolled out in airports across the country. TSA checkpoints can have videos featuring government officials, but they normally don't contain partisan messages. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Stocks fell sharply today after President Trump threatened to impose even steeper tariffs on imports from China. And now he's followed through, announcing a new additional 100% tariff. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow tumbled 878 points, or nearly 2%.
President Trump posted his threat on social media after China imposed new restrictions on exports of rare earth materials. Trump described that as a hostile act that could clog commercial flows around the world. Trump said he'd been planning to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping later this month at an Asia-Pacific summit in South Korea, but he warned that meeting could be scrapped now. In addition to a 100% increase in tariffs next month, Trump warned he could hit back at China with export restrictions of his own. The tit-for-tat comes after a period when investors had been growing more sanguine that U.S.-China trade tensions might not be as disruptive as initially feared. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
National Guard troops are now patrolling Memphis as part of President Trump's attempt to crack down on crime there. The deployment comes a day after a federal judge temporarily blocked the Guard from being deployed in Chicago. Trump is pushing to deploy the Guard in several cities where he says crime is rampant. This is NPR News from Washington. Unease is mounting ahead of the Chicago Marathon amid the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in the city. The race on Sunday draws thousands from around the world and is a major tourism draw. Organizers sent an email to participants referring to a Know Your Rights page on the city's website. An ICE spokesperson said rumors that agents will be at the race are false. The United Nations says the Taliban's restrictions on the internet are a violation of human rights. Afghanistan experienced a 48-hour internet blackout last month that coincided with a morality drive imposed by the leader of the Taliban. Connectivity has largely been restored, but the UN says the Taliban are still restricting access to popular social media platforms. The Venezuela opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, has won the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize. Julia Carnero has more.
Oh, my God. Well, I have no words.
This was the moment Maria Corina Machado received the news, waking up to a phone call in the middle of the night.
An honor and And I know it's a recognition to our people, to the Venezuelan people.
Machado is the leading figure opposing Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro. She was barred from running for president in 2024. After that election, Maduro claimed victory without detailing the vote count. Since then, Machado has lived in hiding in Venezuela. World leaders praised her courage and commitment to human rights. But the White House offered no congratulations, saying the Nobel Committee had placed politics over peace in failing to award the prize to President Trump. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. A ceasefire is now in effect between Israel and Hamas. The Israeli military has pulled back from certain positions in the Gaza Strip. In the coming days, a hostage and prisoner exchange is set to begin, and hundreds of humanitarian aid trucks are expected to be allowed into Gaza. It's all part of President Trump's 20-point peace plan, a plan whose outline does closely resemble that of his predecessor, former President Joe Biden. Here to talk about this moment and what is ahead is Jake Sullivan. He served as national security advisor to President Biden and was deeply involved in negotiations and policymaking around the Gaza war. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Look, let's start. We've been here before. As you deeply know, you and others in the Biden administration helped broker a multi-phase ceasefire in the final days of the administration. Then it fell apart a couple of months later. So what to you may be different now?
Well, first, I think we have to start with the good news, which is we have a ceasefire. The guns have gone silent. Unless something terrible happens, hostages will be coming out and aid will be going in. And these hostages have been living through hell, and they're finally going to be reunited with their families. And Palestinian civilians have been living through hell, and they're finally going to get a measure of relief. So there are a lot of questions about what comes next for the long term. But in the immediate term, it does look as though all of the parties have determined that the next step will be ceasefire, hostages, aid relief. And that formula is a good formula on a very basic human level.
I wanted to ask you about something that we heard on our show this morning on Morning Edition. We talked to veteran hostage negotiator Gershon Baskin, who was involved in these talks, and he told my colleague Leila Fadel about what was different this time, and he said President Trump made a difference. Here's what he said.
Let's face it, Benjamin Netanyahu and Ron Dermer, his main ally in the Israeli government, support the American Republican Party, not the Democratic Party. They were hostile to Barack Obama. They were hostile to Joe Biden. And they very supportive of Donald Trump. So that was one thing. Biden never had the leverage over Netanyahu that Trump has.
I'm curious what your response is to that statement.
Well, first, I would say that when President Biden left office, there was, as you said, a ceasefire in place. There were hostages coming out. There was aid going in then. And more importantly, there was a roadmap for a final and comprehensive end to the war. Israel actually walked away from that under President Trump, and we had six more months of fighting. So I'm very glad that President Trump finally came around to the view that this war had to end and applied pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu. But I think something else happened as well, which is that Hamas's position got very badly weakened over the course of this time. 1 year ago today, Hamas's leader, Sinwar, was still alive. There were still Hamas military elements. Today, Hamas is a shadow of its former self, and that's part of why we ended up where we are.
Yeah.
So I believe that it's a combination of facts on the ground and the fact that it was time for the American president, past time for the American president, in this case, President Trump, to bring pressure to bear to end this war.
I do want to ask about one more contrast between Presidents Trump and Biden that a lot of people in Israel especially have been telling our reporters that they felt like President Trump was much more willing to make direct threats in public, in private, and they felt like that made a difference in getting both sides to try to end this war. Do you think there's any accuracy to that?
Well, I didn't really see direct threats in public against Prime Minister Netanyahu. I've seen some reported threats that he made privately, but not publicly. And of course, President Biden had very tough private conversations with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I did see some of the public threats with respect to Hamas, but he made those threats 6 months ago, and obviously Hamas kept fighting. He's mm-hmm. made them recently. So to me, the key thing here is that Israel had no more military objectives to achieve in Gaza, and Hamas had lost a huge amount of its capacity to continue to resist militarily. And when you put those two things together, this situation was ripe to be resolved. I would argue that it was ripe to be resolved months ago after the first ceasefire came into place, and that we've had months of needless fighting. But I am glad that they finally come around to the position where they've got the ceasefire in place. And now I hope that they can make it durable by actually working on the remaining points of this plan.
What are your biggest questions about what the Israeli government and military does in the coming months based on all of your experiences dealing with them?
Well, a huge question is what actually happens with the disposition of Israeli forces inside Gaza. They've pulled back to a certain extent, but they, of course, have not fully withdrawn. And then a second main question is what happens to Hamas? To what extent are there Hamas fighters who continue to operate inside Gaza in the future? And then the final question is who will govern Gaza as we go forward? The right answer is a Palestinian government that does not include Hamas, does not include any terrorist organizations. Is that achievable? I think these are all very difficult and challenging, both logistical and political issues. And it's what the Americans and all of the Arab countries, as well as the Israelis and Palestinians, are going to have to turn to next.
I've noticed that you've been pretty introspective in recent interviews. I read a quote where you said that sometimes you have a hard time sleeping at night just because of the nature of the job you held for 4 years. I'm wondering, do you in this moment, as you think about things and how this took 2 years, is there anything you're thinking, perhaps if we had done this differently, exerted pressure differently, this war could have ended sooner?
Of course I think about that. I think about that all the time because there's been such a massive human toll for innocent Palestinians, a massive human toll for the hostages and their families. So I wrestle with that every day, and I don't think I'd be human if I didn't. But I think it's also important to recognize, again, that we left office with a ceasefire in place, and that ceasefire broke down in March, and we've had 6 months of fighting since President Trump has been president, or more than 6 months of fighting. So I hope the Trump administration is also asking itself the same question. Mm-hmm. Is there anything they could have done to end the war sooner than now? And is there any lesson that they take from the last time the ceasefire broke down to make sure that it doesn't break down again?
That is Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor under former President Joe Biden. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, the Trump administration says that, quote, substantial layoffs of federal workers have begun, appearing to follow through on its threats to cut down the size of the government during the shutdown. Now, it's not clear yet how many agencies are affected or how many employees are receiving these reduction in force or RIF memos. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been covering the restructuring of the federal government and joins us now to explain what we do know. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
Hey. Okay, so what do we know?
Not a lot yet, Elsa. It's important to note that the news came from the Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt posting on X simply, "The RIFs have begun." Now, an OMB spokesperson not authorized to speak publicly told NPR that the process was starting and that it would be, quote, substantial, but we don't really know what that means. Now, NPR's seen screenshots of notifications at places like the Environmental Protection Agency and the Housing and Urban Development saying there will be RIFs. Some unions representing employees at agencies like the Education Department say they've also been told layoffs are coming, but that's not the same as official notices sent to employees. One agency so far did confirm those RIF notices did go out.
Oh, wait, which agency?
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin heard from the Department of Health and Human Services. An HHS spokesman said employees that are considered non-essential across multiple divisions receive them, though it doesn't say how many or when they take effect. Their statement also says the department was bloated and the cuts are the, quote, consequence of the Democrat-led government shutdown. Now, I spoke with Jessica Riedel, a government spending expert at the center-right Manhattan Institute, earlier this week about the threat of RIFs and how the White House has blamed proposed drastic cuts on the government shutdown. She said this.
There is no statute requiring them to lay off a substantial share of federal employees during a temporary government shutdown. That statute doesn't exist. And such practice has not occurred during previous shutdowns.
So what she's saying is that you don't need to make permanent changes based on a temporary situation.
Okay. Well, the thing is, some government employees are working without pay right now. Others are furloughed. So do we have any sense of how all that might be affecting these layoff decisions?
There are three main groups of federal employees right now, those who are working without pay, those who are working with pay because their funding isn't dependent on Congress passing a bill, and those that are furloughed. Okay. That last group of people are likely the ones being targeted because agencies have deemed them to be non-essential during a shutdown. The Office of Management and Budget and its director, Russell Vogt, argued before the shutdown that any non-essential programs, employees, activities should be eliminated. Now, a group of federal employee unions filed a lawsuit also before the shutdown that says the mere threat of firings and trying to carry them out during a shutdown is illegal. That case is ongoing and there's a hearing next week.
Help me understand something, Stephen. The Trump administration says that federal agencies need to be cut down, but it's also blaming the shutdown for why these agencies are shrinking. Can you reconcile that for me?
It's mixed messaging from the White House. I mean, the administration officials say that Democrats caused the government shutdown. The government shutdown means they have to make hard choices about spending and staffing, and the White House feels forced to make those tough decisions. At the same time, though, this is an extension of the Department of Government efficiency push to slash the federal government's size and scope that's been underway since January. Mm-hmm. That includes firing workers. I'll also note that some of these agencies are already smaller after the DOGE cuts and buyouts and retirements, but before the shutdown, NPR reported some of them were actually hiring people back because they couldn't carry out basic tasks or fulfill Trump's policy priorities.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for She Rose Radio, amplifying female voices and music with Carmel Holt. This week's featured guest is Melina Duterte, a.k.a. J-Som, celebrating the release of her first album in 6 years, Belong. And we receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has a spooktacular breakfast buffet Sunday, October 12th from 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center, 12 miles north of Nashwauk. Save a buck if you wear a costume. And we receive support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtCenter.org. The Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation announces the Itasca Area 100 Plus Women Who Care Giving Circle Monday, October 13th at Timberlake Lodge. Registration begins at 5 p.m., program at 5:30. Attendees each contribute $100, and nonprofits are nominated to receive the collective donation. Find more information and register on Facebook. Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night Thursday, October 16th from 7 to 9. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Mountain biking was invented in the U.S., but it spread quickly from California and Colorado around the world. And Americans, well, they have not really dominated mountain bike racing since the early days of the sport. Though, there have been moments.
It's Blevins taking it. Can Grashi come round? Christopher Blevins wins. He takes the double in Lake Placid.
Christopher Blevins wins. Last weekend, Christopher Blevins became the first American man to win the overall World Cup of cross-country mountain biking since 1991. In fact, he clinched both the short track and the Olympic distance series by winning both World Cup races last weekend in Lake Placid, New York. And before his race today in Canada, he spoke with us. Hello, hello.
Hi, Elsa. Great to be here. Thank you.
It's so great to have you. Okay, there were USA chants in the crowd immediately once you crossed that finish line in Lake Placid. Can you just talk about what was that like?
Yeah, it was amazing. I felt just incredibly fortunate to have that much support and love. And you don't get many fairy tale moments in sports. You get a lot of hard moments, a lot of harsh reality. But that was definitely a culmination of the season, of the work, and really my whole career. So it was special to experience.
Would you say that there's more momentum for mountain bike racing in the U.S. these days compared to at least like when you were growing up? Like, I'm told there have been some other prominent successes for Americans in other mountain bike disciplines lately, like downhill or ultra endurance marathon racing and the like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we can attribute the growth in mountain bike racing success at the top level is at the bottom, in the grassroots level. Mm-hmm. NICA is a high school mountain bike race league that has taken off in some states massively. And, you know, I think when the general American thinks about mountain biking, it's seen as a recreational activity, not so much an elite sport. Mm-hmm. And I think with programs like NICA and just more kids on bikes enjoying it, not just in racing, that's starting to draw more of a connection between what I do and the Olympic level of the sport with the youth development programs.
That's so cool. Your dad also raced, right?
Yeah, my dad is probably training and racing just as seriously as I am as a 66-year-old retired surgeon, but he loves it.
Yeah, that's what I heard. You come from a family, a pretty prominent black doctors going back several generations. Is that right?
Yeah.
So can you talk about like how bike racing and medicine interact in your family?
Well, yeah, cycling, you know, and medicine is really, I think, what the Blevins are known for. And my sister is about to graduate from med school. She stopped racing while she was in Stanford. It got a little too serious for her. So she's really the she's really the rock star of the family, and she's carrying on the Dr. Blevins lineage.
Amazing.
And yeah.
You guys are all a bunch of overachievers. I do want to know, though, you know, competitive cycling in general has had few people of color, and mountain biking specifically even less so, right? Like, so have you ever thought about what your race or your family history means in this context?
Yeah. So my grandpa was one of the first black physicians in major LA, you know, public hospitals. And, you know, I grew up in a small town, Durango, Colorado, with 20,000 people that is entirely embedded in mountain bike culture and racing. I think that that support and that opportunity has made me realize like how many other communities, underprivileged communities, could benefit from the bike as a tool for health and wellness and just general well-being of kids. Close to Durango and the Navajo Nation, there's a nonprofit called Silver Stallion Bicycles that I'm on the board of. And I've really like been just amazed at how this sport I've loved can help underprivileged communities. And I think I do attribute that a bit to my family history and recognizing what my grandpa, you know, went through to become a doctor and carry that forward.
I love that. Well, Durango, I understand, is home to the very first mountain bike world championship, right? Like, you weren't even alive yet, but you could have a shot at the recently announced 2030 world championship returning to Durango for the first time in 40 years. How does that feel?
Yeah.
About competing in your hometown?
Yeah. No, it's absolutely incredible. Ned Overend was my neighbor, and he won that first world championship in 1990.
Oh, God, full circle. Or it could be full circle moment.
Yeah, and he's a family friend. And again, the organic nature of Durango, like, it's just what kids do. They just get on bikes and see how far they can go. And it's brought me pretty far. And if Durango 2030 world championships is my retirement party, it'd be a pretty good one. So we'll see.
Oh, Christopher Blevins, the new World Cup winner, thank you so much and good luck this weekend.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Elsa.
Winter in Fairbanks, Alaska is brutal. Think lows in the negative 30s and sunsets in the afternoon, and winter arrives early, right around now. That is all tough for people with seasonal depression. As the Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert reports, one man in the city has a unique antidote to his winter blues, balloon art.
In the summer months, Bill Torgerson is kind of like a professional clown, sans makeup. For about a decade, his full-time job has been making balloon animals, ninja swords, and other balloon objects for kids at birthday parties, bar mitzvahs, and public festivals. At a Labor Day barbecue, he was wearing a big yellow bow tie, towering over a long line of kids that looped around his booth. He'll make them anything they want.
The only thing that really ever holds me back is the amount of balloons and the amount of time that I've got.
10-year-old Ellen Schreiner asked for a hamburger.
And I don't think he's, like, really made that one before because he was like, but then he made it for me.
But right about now, that work drops off. He still does some indoor events, but it's slow. And with snow starting to fall already in the Alaska interior, the part of the year that's hardest for him is getting started. The cold air can create a temperature inversion, trapping wood smoke and other pollution close to the ground like fog, and touching exposed metal can give you frostbite in an instant. That's when Torgerson, who lives with severe clinical depression, feels the most vulnerable.
Right after the holiday season, a lot of people end up getting really depressed during like January. And so like me in particular, I have a lot of struggles with that.
What helps keep his spirits up are bigger and wilder balloon art creations that he just does for his own enjoyment. For example, an almost 13-foot tall Godzilla costume made of balloons that covers his entire body. Or a giant balloon chandelier.
And it really helps keep me going. It is basically the fresh breath of life that I'm kind of hoping to put out there that I need for myself.
He shows those projects off on TikTok to an audience of over 30,000 followers.
Hi, everybody. I'm Incredible Balloons. I'm going to teach you how to make some incredible balloons today.
His most popular videos have around 500,000 views.
I like the idea of being able to bring something so unique and so literally big to my small town.
This winter, he's trying to break the Guinness World Record for the tallest balloon costume, this time 15 feet tall. For NPR News, I'm Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. Now for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report.
The wife of a well-known Brainerd Lakes area camp director who died by suicide in jail filed a wrongful death lawsuit Thursday against Crow Wing County and one of its correctional officers. Chelsea Perkins has the story.
57-year-old Robert Bob Slaba spent 36 years as director of Confidence Learning Center in East Gull Lake, which provides outdoor experiences for people with disabilities. His February 2024 death occurred within an hour of him being placed in a jail cell after his arrest for driving while intoxicated. The suit states Correctional Officer Brandon Anderson placed him in a general population cell stocked with a sheet and a bunk previously identified by state officials as a suicide hazard, despite a, quote, overwhelming combination of risk factors. Slaba registered a 0.282 blood alcohol concentration and disclosed that he suffered from anxiety, sleeping disorders, a prior suicide attempt within the last 6 months, and past hospitalization for mental health problems. He also answered yes to multiple questions on the jail's mental health screening that, by the jail's own policy, required he be referred for an immediate mental health evaluation. Reached Friday, Crow Wing County Sheriff Eric Klang declined to comment on the lawsuit. Klang did, however, confirm the hazardous bunks have been replaced as of October 2024. The lawsuit seeks financial compensation for Slaba's errors based on two violations of his constitutional rights and his wrongful death under Minnesota law. Attorneys for the defendants will have the opportunity to file an answer to the suit in U.S. District Court. Read more about this story at KAXE.org. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
A faulty breath test may have compromised driving while intoxicated charges in at least three counties because of user error. The Minnesota Star Tribune reports that a Datamaster instrument to test blood alcohol content was installed incorrectly in Aiken, Winona, and Chippewa counties. More than 70 tests in Aiken County could have been compromised, with at least one fourth-degree DWI case being dismissed there due to the error. The error was flagged by Metro Area Defense Attorney Chuck Ramsey, who represented two clients charged with DWI in Aiken County. The BCA notified all law enforcement agencies across the state of the issue and told the Star Tribune that Aiken County had stopped using the device until the error was resolved. While not as heavily attended as the hearing at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds last week, the final public hearing for a contested boundary dispute saw at least a dozen from the Bemidji area speak before the judge. Northern Township seeks to become its own city and construct a new wastewater plant to serve properties on its side of Lake Bemidji. Nearby Bemidji is disputing this move with a counterpetition that would annex properties around the lake into the city limits. Several affected property owners spoke during the Wednesday hearing at the Sanford Center, including Ron Cooperis, who has been gathering signatures for a petition protesting the annexation. Cooperis's petition does not comment on the sewer issue.
The sewer issue kind of muddies up the big issue here, which is annexation. The real core issue here that brings us to this point is that there's been a change in fiscal responsibility philosophies through the years.
Others on the affected route supported Bemidji's annexation petition, claiming it would cost less to connect to the city system than pay the special assessments for Northern's wastewater plant. Beltrami County Commissioner Joe Gould supports Bemidji's petition. He says the city was in the right to annex as cities need to grow. He adds while the regional goal for decades has been to get sewer around the lake, there has been resistance from nearby townships to the city growing by annexation. Gould said in an interview that the differences between Northern and Bemidji are philosophical.
I think it's just the nature of rural way of life. You know, people that live outside of the city, they're used to having a little more flexibility, looser regulations. It's cultural.
Written comments can be submitted to the Court of Administrative Hearings by 4:30 p.m. on October 24th. Northern Township and the City of Bemidji are expected to continue filing items on their respective cases through December 1st, with the judge's decision not expected to come before the end of the year. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. This year's Nobel Peace Prize went to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. In its announcement, the Norwegian Nobel Committee called her a, quote, brave and committed champion of peace. Machado has been in hiding in Venezuela since her opposition party lost in 2024 to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in what was widely denounced as a rigged election. Machado is a close ally of President Trump, who had been lobbying publicly for the prize for himself. For more, let's go to NPR South America correspondent Carrie Kahn. Hey, Carrie.
Hi.
So what did the Nobel Committee say in announcing her as the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize winner?
The committee called her, quote, a woman who keeps the flame of democracy burning amid a growing darkness. The committee director posted his call with Maria Corina Machado early this morning before the announcement. She was clearly stunned. You can hear it. And she quickly deflected the praise from herself to what she said is the people of Venezuela fighting for democracy.
I am just, one person. I certainly do not deserve this. Oh my God.
I think both the movement and you deserve it.
Wow. Tell us more about Machado's work in Venezuela.
She has long been an outspoken critic of President Nicolas Maduro and previous socialist governments in Venezuela. She tried to run against Maduro in the last election back in 2024, but was barred from running. She backed an elderly, little-known candidate to run in her place, and she just crisscrossed the country, bringing out these huge crowds to oppose Maduro. And this part was really important. She built this amazing cadre of election observers who were able to collect an indisputable number of voting tally sheets on election night. And those sheets just came to prove that the election was stolen by Maduro and provided a way for the results to be independently validated. The U.S. and many nations decried the fraud.
And Carrie, you covered that election. You traveled with her on several occasions. What can you tell us about her personally?
She's been dubbed Venezuela's Iron Lady, and she definitely is that. Politically, she's very conservative and a free market champion. But during the election, she was singularly focused on ousting Maduro and rallying the country. On this one trip we took with her across the country, she had to travel in the early, early morning hours. She had to try and evade the police, who would often stop her caravans. Airlines wouldn't sell her tickets. Gas stations wouldn't sell her gas. Her drivers carried their own tanks of gas. And we stopped in this one town to refill tanks and meet supporters, and I jumped in her SUV, and she just told me she really believed in electoral democracy and that the opposition could win.
We have to defeat the tyranny, and we have to build a country around trust in each other and dignity.
Right after the election, she held huge rallies decrying the fraud. And that was very brave of her, because soon after Maduro cracked down on the opposition, more than 24 people died and thousands were jailed, according to human rights observers. And soon after, she went into hiding.
She thanked President Trump today. How important of an ally is President Trump?
He is very important to her and her campaign to oust Maduro. The U.S. right now has this large flotilla of naval destroyers off the coast of Venezuela in an unprecedented use of the U.S. military in the fight against drug trafficking. She supported that, the military's recent deadly strikes against alleged drug trafficking boats from Venezuela. The government there has accused Trump of promoting regime change, and she's had to walk this really difficult political line as Trump has cracked down on Venezuelan migrants in the U.S. too. And she was quite astute today, thanking Trump publicly. President Trump reposted her post thanking him. And the White House was, however, not as cordial and blasted the Nobel Committee for its choice, saying it proved they placed politics over peace in giving her the award.
That is NPR's Carrie Kahn. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It is day 10 of the government shutdown, and on Capitol Hill, there have been almost no signs of progress. The Senate has voted seven times on the same two short-term funding measures, and seven times they failed to end the shutdown. And now, senators say they aren't even formally negotiating. So, what are they doing? NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass spent some time with senators asking just that.
Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
Is not agreed to.
Not agreed to.
Is not agreed to.
This motion is not agreed to.
Day after day, lawmakers have been filing into the Senate chamber to vote on the same two proposals to reopen the government. One backed by mostly Republicans, the other by Democrats. The spending bills need 60 votes to advance, which means bipartisan support is the only way forward.
People really are just kind of dug in, and then everything is hyper-politicized.
Democratic Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania has been one of two Democrats voting with Republicans on a bill to fund the government for a few more weeks. Most Democrats are holding out for a deal to renew expiring health insurance subsidies. Sitting on a bench outside the chamber, Fetterman says the endless loop of votes is not what he envisioned serving in the Senate would be like.
I think people should realize that there's no glamour.
President James Buchanan described the U.S. Senate as the world's greatest deliberative body. Asked senators this week if they think that's true, and you get a lot of responses like this from Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia.
I wish we did more deliberating.
Even so, he says voting no on the Republican-backed bill in order to preserve the subsidies is exactly what his constituents sent him to Washington to do. Warnock, a Baptist pastor, says maybe his colleagues across the aisle will come around.
It's never too late to come to Jesus.
At the onset of the shutdown, Republicans promised cracks in the Democratic caucus. Democrats said they would soon peel off Republicans. Neither has happened. Here's Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana.
The further we go, the deeper we get dug in. That's Western.
And that can make it seem a little like Groundhog Day. Republican Senator Tom Tillis walked away from a press gaggle muttering, "My God, make it stop." Independent Senator Angus King of Maine says he doesn't believe this is what the founders intended.
If you think about it, we've only really passed, I think, two or three bills this year, and that's not what this institution was designed to do.
But some lawmakers are trying to keep that spirit of give and take alive. A bipartisan group of senators traded ideas over Thai food earlier this week, though Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski was tight-lipped about the details.
I don't talk about what happens at mealtimes.
Why is it important to keep having informal gatherings like that at this
time? Talking, absolutely. If you don't have communication, nothing changes, right?
Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma also attended, but skipped the Thai food.
I like cheeseburgers. I like hot dogs. I like Pop-Tarts. I like cookies.
Mullen says the group didn't negotiate the end of a shutdown. They talked about what should happen after.
Because we trust each other and we can have candid conversations, and they've been, I think, pretty productive.
There have been glimmers of a potential path forward, like a possible vote after reopening the government to extend the subsidies. That's why Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia says the repetitive votes are not a waste.
Votes tend to be the reason that everybody comes to the floor and then spends time talking to try to find a solution. We haven't found a solution yet, but we're going to keep at it.
But on Friday, the senators went home for the weekend with no deal and the shutdown now stretching into another week. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. An unlikely basketball hero died Thursday. Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt was chaplain for the men's basketball team at Loyola University Chicago. She was front and center when the Ramblers made it to the NCAA's Final Four in 2018, and that turned her into an international celebrity. Sister Jean was 106. Reporter Adora Nami Gade has this remembrance.
Before becoming a religious sister, Sister Jean's name was Dolores Bertha Schmidt. She was born in 1919 and grew up in a devout Catholic family in San Francisco, California. In her memoir, Sister Jean talked about maintaining a youthful spirit and how she played intramural basketball just as the sport was becoming popular for women and girls. She recounted how early on, when she was just 10 years old, she knew she wanted to become a religious sister.
I would pray in the morning and I would
ask God, please help me know what you want me to do, but tell me you want me to be a BVM sister.
When she graduated from high school, Sister Jean did join the BVM Sisters. That is, the Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary. As a member of that order, she spent many years teaching at Mundelein College for Women, the school founded by the BVM Sisters in 1930 on Chicago's North Side. The college became part of Loyola Chicago in 1991, and a few years later, Loyola's president offered Sister Jean a job helping student athletes maintain their grades for eligibility. That position ended up evolving into her chaplaincy of the men's basketball team. That's when she would tell players about the importance of a good sense of humor and hard work. Tom Welch joined Loyola's Ramblers in 2019 and says what he admired most about Sister Jean was her willpower.
Sometimes as a student athlete, you struggle with motivation to get out of bed, get to class, go to practice, you know, kind of give it your all at everything you do in a day. And if she can do it, there's no reason I can't.
Welch added it was also impressive to watch Sister Jean, the basketball connoisseur, constantly come up with game plans and scout teams they were playing. So perhaps no surprise that Sister Jean's claim to international fame came in her late 90s, when the Loyola men's basketball team made it to the Final Four for the first time in 32 years. It was 2018, and there was Sister Jean, decked out in the school's maroon and gold regalia. The Ramblers received national attention in the school's historic run, winning some of the games with buzzer-beating shots. Sister Jean clapped her hands as she cheered on from the sidelines in her wheelchair all along the way. The team ended their March Madness basketball dream in a loss to University of Michigan. In her memoir, Waking Up with Purpose, Sister Jean talks about the importance of setting aside daily quiet time and maintaining a forgiving spirit. Still, basketball was never far from her mind. Bill Burns, a former Loyola athletic director, was particularly struck by the way Sister Jean faithfully watched games from home and kept in touch with the Ramblers during the COVID pandemic.
For somebody that's 80 years older than those guys, to still be able to maintain that relationship with them and have to adjust on the fly and do it in some ways technologically was pretty impressive.
Sister Jean remained a campus celebrity and a Chicago icon because of her dedication to education, her camaraderie with students, and her love of college basketball. But the relationship she had with God early on in life was always her first priority, and she had a simple wish.
Well, when I die, I want to go to heaven, and I want my friends to be there too.
In 2017, Sister Jean was inducted into the Loyola Ramblers Athletic Hall of Fame. And to ensure that she is remembered here on Earth, Loyola erected a memorial for her outside the train stop near campus. It reads, Home of the world-famous Sister Jean. For NPR News, I'm Adora Namigadde in Chicago.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. The Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota, with musical trio Kaylee, now through November 5th. Find a full list of dates, times, and locations at als.info. Support comes from Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Sketches of Minnesota, a civic community comedy tour, on Saturday, October 11th. Doors at 5 p.m., dinner at 6. Open to all with registration required. Info at edgecenterarts.org. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm-fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. United Way Bemidji will distribute coats for the community tomorrow from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church on Bemidji Avenue North. Anyone in need of a winter items is welcome. It's Pumpkin Fest in downtown Aurora tomorrow from 10 to 3. Enjoy crafts, a costume contest, wagon rides, live music, and more. Find a full schedule at celebrateaurora.com. Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning presents Doug Omen at the Bagley American Legion Wednesday, October 15th at 9:30. Omen will talk about Barnes of Minnesota. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ilse Chang. What is the role of satire in a country's political life? Well, that's a question that many Americans have been asking lately, especially after comedian Jimmy Kimmel had his late-night TV show suspended briefly by ABC, a move that was celebrated by President Trump and some on the right. The American debate over free speech and comedy resonates quite loudly in France and Russia, two countries where satirical puppet shows became popular by making fun of the powerful, only to end up off the air. From Paris and Moscow, NPR's Eleanor Beardsley and Charles Maines report. We begin with Eleanor.
In France, in the late 80s, a TV show called Les Guignols de l'Info, or The Puppets of the News, helped shape the national conversation with marionettes.
Aujourd'hui, c'est Jacques Chirac et Edouard Balladur qui
Any French politician or celebrity could be transformed into a larger-than-life latex version of themselves and held up for ridicule. Les Guignols came on just before the nightly news, and their jokes became a measure of the national mood.
Je suis Yves Le Roland et j'ai été le producteur artistique.
Yves Le Roland was creative director for Les Guignols for 21 years. He says the big breakthrough came with the first Gulf War in 1990, which France took part in. Les Guignols lampooned generals while poking fun at the video game-like coverage of the conflict.
Ça provoquait un décalage qui faisait qu'on pouvait dire beaucoup plus de choses.
The fact that we did satire with marionettes made a kind of delay with reality that let us get away with a lot more than if it was a stand-up comedian who says things directly.
Ah oui, qu'est-ce qui m'a mis là maintenant? Alors, 20h30.
A favorite guignol was the hapless President Jacques Chirac. The show portrayed him as an everyman who just wanted a beer and a sausage. Turns out that portrayal may have helped him, says Le Roland.
On a même dit que les guignols, à force de se moquer,
it was even said that by mocking Chirac so mercilessly, we made him look sympathetic. And in the end, it actually helped get him elected president.
Kukli, or puppets, was Russia's answer to Les Guignols de l'Info. The show launched in the mid-1990s and similarly skewered Russia's political elite, including then-president Boris Yeltsin. Viktor Shendorovich, the show's key writer, says he quickly realized the power of satire.
Laughter as a weapon is powerful because laughter is irrefutable. You can win a case in court, but a court can't force people to stop laughing at you.
The show was a test of new freedoms in a country where mocking Soviet rulers was done in private. And in fact, Kukli faced pressure from Russian authorities, with one powerful exception.
To whoever complained about Kukli, Yeltsin would say, "If I could put up with it, you can too."
In 1999, an aging Yeltsin resigned, handing power to his then relatively unknown Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin. By now, he too had a puppet. Shendorovich satirized Putin's sudden rise to power, borrowing from an old German fairy tale. He cast Putin in the role of a dwarf, mistaken through magic as a handsome prince. Until the spell wore off. The fallout was almost immediate.
Putin took it as a personal insult on his physical stature that he was a dwarf. But for me, it was just a metaphor. Not least because I am not tall. I am even shorter than Putin.
The state soon launched criminal investigations and demanded changes at Kukli's network, an independent commercial channel called NTV. Among them, Putin's puppet and NTV's critical news coverage should disappear for good.
In France, the shutdown was slower and more subtle. Enter Vincent Bolloré, right-wing billionaire industrialist and friend of then-President Nicolas Sarkozy, who was a favorite in Guignol's skits.
Sarkozy, président! Sarkozy, président!
Here, Sarkozy trades his Rolex for a swatch to shed his bling-bling image, but when it comes to removing his expensive elevator shoes...
Non, finalement, les chaussures, je les garde, hein?
The famously short president changes his mind. Bruno Gaccio was another longtime producer for Les Guignols. He says Bolloré hated the parodies of Sarkozy.
Bolloré tried to stop the Guignol from President Sarkozy in 2007. He felt it's impossible for him.
It became possible when he bought the channel hosting Les Guignols, Canal+. When Bolloré moved the show from primetime to just before midnight, ratings collapsed, says Gaccio.
It's easy to cancel a show. It's very easy. The only thing needs a billionaire is time and money.
The show eventually folded. Bolloré denied any censorship. He continues to buy newspapers, radio, and TV networks across France.
Добрый вечер.
Watching old clips of NTV on YouTube feels like a window on another country, a more pluralistic Russia that no longer exists. A quarter century later, Shenerovich says the status of satire and satirist is a direct commentary on the political makeup of a country. The show dragged on for another year or so, but with neutered political content, no Putin puppet, and no Shenderovich, ratings sagged. By then, NTV had been taken over by Gazprom, Russia's state energy giant. It was the beginning of the end of an era of free speech in Russia.
It was never just about the fate of Kukli. After the show's end, the genre of satire disappeared. Under Putin, it became impossible to make fun of the head of state.
Or, it turns out, his policies.
Ivan Urgant is Russia's most popular and only late-night talk show host.
In the wake of the war in Ukraine, new censorship laws banned even the mildest criticism of the Russian invasion, including by Ivan Urgant, heard here with American late-night host Stephen Colbert in Moscow in 2017.
So we're more close to Fallon than to John Oliver.
Does Putin watch your show?
The answer, apparently yes. 5 years later, Urgant's show was canceled after the host made an appeal for peace. Shenderovich, who now lives in exile, says that's no surprise.
The years of relative freedom weren't long enough to become the norm.
Unlike Russia, the West has a tradition of mocking its rulers, adds Shenderovich. Even now, he still believes that's true.
That was NPR's Charles Maines reporting from Moscow, with NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reporting from Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at AtchisonTire.com. And looking at weather tonight, clear skies with lows in the mid to upper 30s. Tomorrow, sunny with temps in the low to mid 60s. Breezy south winds, overnight lows near 50. And Sunday, breezy and mostly cloudy with a good chance of showers.